Good morning, everyone. Today we have a very special show about the arts and language. The language of art is very important to Sheila and I, and today we want to explore the common language in the visual arts and music. Sheila and I both love music immensely, and I think it's very interesting to share with our listeners the similar language in these two art forms. Many months ago, we did a series of programs on the relationship between poetry and the visual arts, and we had a guest poet on the show and a contributor to the Artist Experience radio show, Peter Blake. We discussed language in that show as well and how it's closely related to poetry, which is also related to music. Today, we bring a musician, a pianist, organist, choral director, and conductor of several choirs to the studio. We have my friend Lyle Peters with us, a recent arrival to the D.C. Baltimore area. He has degrees in musical composition from Oral Roberts University and a master's from California State University at Fresno. He will be sharing in the dialogue with the words we use in music and the visual arts. Also, I want Bobby Hill to chime in here with Lyle and share his incredible expertise about music and his years of dedication to music and musical variety, and especially on the radio. Don't be shy, Bobby. Sheila will not be with us this morning. She's on assignment. You have been immersed in music all your life, Lyle. Tell us a little about those early musical inspirations.
Music from my earliest memories is from my family members who sang. Going to church, I learned to follow music from my mom. She'd have her finger following the words in the hymnal as she leaned it on the pew. And then I was in choirs all through grade school and high school and college. Piano lessons began at 8 years old, saxophone in the fourth grade, and I was fortunate enough to be chosen for all-state choirs my junior and senior year in high school. So I started in kindergarten with, as far as visual art, started in kindergarten with finger painting and progressed to stick figures, but I'm afraid I didn't get much beyond that.
Oh, shame on you, Lyle. Yeah. You could have gone beyond stick figures. Anyway, there's so much in the visual arts to share with music. The vocabulary is the same in so many areas of sound and mark making, such as in drawing and painting. We'll be talking about a range of words that are meaningful in both art genres, such as composition, sequence, tone, a word which we hear in music and art a lot, and also in value, that's synonymous with tone in visual art, and of course, rhythm and tempo.
And we will also be discussing dynamics, such as soft and loud, and all those sexy Italian words that go with it, like pianissimo and mezzo forte.
Oh boy, I can't wait.
Range, as in vocal music, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, and in visual arts, the high, middle, and low key in drawing refers to the range of values used in a work of art. Then there's accent or emphasis in music, or visual arts use the term visual focal point or emphasis.
Well, why don't we start off with probably the most important word, and that's composition. Well, composition actually exists in every art form. In writing, even such a thing as simple as a letter, remember that? Mm-hmm. Way back in grammar school, the introduction, the body of the letter, and the conclusion, that's what you need to compose a letter, traditionally. You know, I ask this question to my students these days, and with texting and emails and all their, you know, modus operandi with that, they kind of shake their heads about that concept of writing a letter. Well, communication has changed. Do we even write letters anymore? I don't know. Well, in dance, composition is called choreography. That's a very old word, and it means the dance from the first movement to the last, or the writing of the dance. And in theater, composition, a stage set. So in poetry, there's a composition, and of course, music. Heck, we even talk about human beings as art forms, right? You remember that old-fashioned expression, "Oh, that person is so well composed." Mm-hmm. My younger students really kind of don't use that, and they look at me like I'm an old fuddy-duddy when I use it. But anyway, well, it means that they're together as a unit, possibly physically, emotionally, and possibly spiritual. And that's a one impressive unit of the whole. Well, how does the musician or composer define musical composition?
Tom, in music, there are various genres of composition. With each style, there's a certain form or possibly even lack of form. For example, In classical music, a sonata or a concerto or a symphony, they all have guidelines of what should be done. Usually, there's a cohesive unit of sound and silence that makes sense to the composer and the listener. However, in some music, the sense of cohesiveness may be apparent only to the composer and not to the listener. In global, cultural, and historical time periods, what seems cohesive to one person or persons might not make sense to another person or persons.
Oh, that's interesting. And in the case of how music changes or evolves over time, that's somewhat true in art as well, visual art. Well, to the visual artist, composition means the visual whole, from the top to bottom, the left to the right of that particular visual. Well, excuse me. You know, you look at the visual and you make a judgment. Very rarely does somebody say, "I like 47.5% of that piece of artwork." It does. That's not what happens. You know,
I've never heard anyone say that.
You either like it or you don't. You know, but you don't look at the specifics and make some kind of quantitative judgment on it. You react to the whole composition. Lyle, how is that wholeness related in musical words? Because I use this a lot when I'm teaching composition for visual artists. How about like words like symphony and harmony? I've always felt those words are also described a kind of wholeness in music.
In music, symphony and harmony both have more than one meaning. Symphony, to most people, immediately brings up the idea of an orchestra or a piece of music written for an orchestra. But the word is developed from its original meaning, which is to sound together. Mm. Harmony is the combination of simultaneously sounded musical notes to produce progressions that have a pleasing effect, whether choral or instrumental in nature.
Well, another word that's pervasive in music is the word tone. And in visual art, we use that word also with the word value. How do you define tone in music?
Well, tone usually is referred to as, you know, the word timbre. And it refers to the character or quality of a musical sound or a voice as distinct from its pitch and intensity. For example, it's relatively easy to distinguish the different timbre or tone of a flute, which, to describe it as kind of roundish or smooth, in contrast to an oboe or a bassoon, which has a reedy or edgier sound. As far as voice goes, it's a bit harder to describe the timbre in a voice, but you can notice it because you can recognize someone's voice even over the phone by their timbre.
Very interesting. Well, I like the way you use the word roundish or smooth, because that kind of deals with something textural or is talking about shape. Visual artists use both those words, tone and value, synonymously. Do musicians ever use the word value?
We use the word value, but it's not synonymous with the way that you use it. Value is used in music as a completely different sense. It refers usually to the length of notes being sounded or the length of a rest, the silence in a music.
Well, I can't get over it, but my throat is tickling all of a sudden, and that's a kind of music, and not a very pleasant one, though. Well, value and tone relates to the relationships between the lights and the darks and in everything in between, like the shades of gray. In color, we use the word hue, which refers to values in a color family, like the difference between pink and maroon red or lavender and deep purple. Those are all hues in certain color families. I often say to the class, well, like when you go to your favorite hardware store and you see all those swatches in the paint section or the paint department, that's a hue. Do musicians use the word hue, or do they associate colors to sound? And I always think of the blues.
Well, there is the use of that term, the blues in music, which refers to a whole style of music. But in my thinking, that's really the only reference other than compositional titles that you might have heard. We don't talk about the greens or the reds of music, but when it's used, it usually refers to a visual reference like White Christmas or Midnight Blue or My Red Shoes.
It's not used in that sense. Interesting. So there's a little difference there. Well, color associated with sounds gets to an entire topic. which involves synesthesia, which are two or more senses working together to create another response aesthetically. And Sheila and I actually are planning to do a show on this actual topic because it's very important for a visual artist as well as other artists, the emotive response to the senses in art making. And Van Gogh and Vasily Kandinsky and Johannes Eiten have talked about this a lot in their work. When you talk about tone or value or hue, it brings up an entire range of visual art and music that is related to tone. Let's enumerate them because there's a subset of value in tone. Law, why don't you chime in on these words like contrast?
Okay, contrast. That would be things like the difference between loud and soft, smooth and connected, or short and disconnected, pleasant and unpleasant, as in major and minor, key or chord, high, low, things like that.
Ah, I got you. Okay, because contrast, of course, is used a little bit differently there, but it's a huge topic in painting and drawing. But I like to talk about a fancy term, which is called tenebrism, which we use about talking about value. And that's when you have a lot of dark darks in a composition next to a lot of very light lights in a drawing or painting. And this creates a very dramatic, theatrical, melodramatic kind of nature to a painting or a drawing. And you see this in the Mannerist period, which is after the Renaissance, with great artists like Caravaggio, whom we've talked about a lot on the show, and also Guido Reni and the Frenchman Georges Latour. They usually used candles in a space and everything else was dark. So it was a contrast issue with lights and darks. What about the word scale? Because I've been talking all week about that in class, and I'm kind of tired of it, actually. But why don't you take over on the word scale?
Well, here again, scale has a couple of different uses or meanings in music. Most people would think of scale as in, for example, the movie musical Sound of Music, or their second grade music class where they were taught do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, major scale. But the word scale in music might also refer to the length or the complexity of a composition. So what's the scale? How big is it? So again, a couple different meanings that can be used.
Well, thanks, Lyle, for sharing that in a song.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's...
And I'm not warmed up this morning either.
Oh, very good. Okay, not enough coffee, right? Scale derives from the Latin or the Greek word for ladder, which is an equal increment of change over a distance or a range. But that's a little different, huh?
But yeah, Tom, even though the visual lines and spaces on a musical staff are equal distances apart and they're very standardized, the musician knows that the sound of a note from one line to the next line, or one space to the next space, or even one space to a line, is not always exactly the same musical interval. The interval sounding may vary by a half a step. So in actuality, it might look visually equal, but that doesn't mean it is necessarily phonically equal. What you hear, it's not going to be
yes,
the same.
Yes, yes. See, that's a very interesting, not only a phonic distinction, but also a visual distinction from visual art and music. As I have, maybe some of our listeners have experienced this, but have you ever walked up a ladder where the rungs are not equal distances from each other? That's like a handmade ladder. You get that often. It's a very odd experience. And not a very good one because your sense of security and safety is kind of threatened there. I don't recommend it. But in that sense, it's related to scale. The equal change of tones in a drawing is a consideration to arrange as well to create, to define the three-dimensional illusion on a two-dimensional surface so it looks like something that looks lifelike. Well, range is used also like scale in value and tone. And it's... I like to kind of describe it in modern sense where when you see a corporate logo like McDonald's or Apple, you know, they have very few values. You know, McDonald's is red and gold, okay? They're not interested in reality. That's a very small range in a value. Well, they're interested in reality.
Money reality.
And sales, yeah, and Happy Meals. But the range of tones in a corporate logo are very few because they're not interested in reality. They're interested in visual punch. But if you had to draw a still life of various fruit, the range would be tremendous because you have to make a dark apple, a light pear, grapes. So, and the wicker basket will say, and there's a value range very, very much so in the darks and lights.
So we want to listen to the range used in this piece of music, one of my favorite pieces of pianos concertos, the opening especially by Edvard Grieg. It's his piano concerto in A minor. And it's just this wonderful range. It starts almost at the very top of the keyboard and goes all the way to the bottom note of the keyboard. So it's a wonderful piece. Let's listen.
Well, that Edvard Grieg piece is all over the piano.
It is.
I mean, I think that's really gives it a great sense of range. And, well, I have to admit, it's very soothing and very kind of mellow. I nearly conked out in the studio. But anyway, well, we're going to talk about key now, which is really important in music, of course, but it's also used in visual art. Could you... Lyle, talk about the significance of key, because, I mean, we hear it so often.
Key's a little tougher to explain, I think, to the non-musician. It refers to how many sharps or flats for a vocalist or instrumentalist in the piece of music they're performing. String players, like violinists and including guitarists, usually prefer playing in keys with sharps because it's easier fingering. Brass players and pianists tend to prefer playing in flat keys. I'm not quite sure why that is, but it's the reality. One reason is, can be fingering on the instrument. Another reason is all instruments resonate better in various keys, you know, particular key. However, there are those who compose in certain keys because they feel the key itself lends itself to a certain emotive feeling, happiness, sadness, whatever. Also, some composers use certain keys because the key is acoustically better for a certain performance venue, that is a church, concert hall, a theater. Some of the musical masters like Palestrina and Vivaldi wrote compositions to be played in a specific place, a specific chapel, because they knew the space resonated with the music in a certain key. So the whole building would, you could just sense that it was working.
Oh, that's so important. I mean, now you're talking about site-specific music. Well, that's site, S-I-T-E. And in other words, composers are using certain keys and instruments to maximize the strength of the particular instrument.
Exactly.
Well, it's the same in visual art. When an artist takes a commission to paint a mural in a site-specific place or a space, like a church, a library, or even on a bridge, the artist has to consider the light and the architectural nuances of the space and the colors they want to use. If you're painting the dome of a church that's really high up and is very high, you know, so high above the ground, you've got to use some punchy, bold colors to communicate that imagery all the way up there. Soft pastel colors, which lack contrast, will probably be not a successful visual statement from a great distance. And, you know, in visual art, key is often described with the kinds of marks you make in the composition. For instance, a high key visual is one that has lots of light and white marks all over the, let's say, the composition. A middle key visual is a mixture of lights and darks, somewhat equal to middle tone marks. And then a low key visual has a lot of dark marks approaching black and dark values, and that's often very melodramatic, could be melancholy, and that's a low-key drawing. And I think, you know, for instance, I mean, you see that in the great Picasso Guernica, where it's a, you know, it's a very sad statement. It's a very evocative emotionally, and so they get a lot of dark. So that's a lot. There's a lot to say about value and tone, but, you know, one of the words I also want to use, and, you know, another sexy Italian word for the show is the word chiaroscuro, which it's two little Latin or Italian words put together, chiaro, which means pure or light, and scuro, which means, or oscuro, which means dark. And this is so important in visuals because it's come to mean light and shadow and light and shade. And chiaroscuro became highly developed in the Renaissance, and all of our listeners probably know by the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Leonardo, Michelangelo, Raphael, and Donatello. That's how I get my students to remember this little fun fact, by importing the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles here. And that's defined by the use of values to create a true, believable three-dimensional illusion on a two-dimensional surface. That occurs when you look at a visual and you emote something like, wow, that really looks real. You know, you hear that a lot. And it's a very believable illusion. Well, that was a beautiful segment talking about value, but we're going to have to take a break. And while we're taking a fabulous music break, go to our website at tacomaradio.org and, you know, constructively think about how the arts on this channel just hits you all the time with fabulous music programming, talk shows, and look at the program schedule and the diversity that we have here in the music, and make a donation when you get a chance. Press the donate button, and you'll be growing with this phenomenal radio station, which is a local phenomenon and beyond. It's becoming a global phenomenon at WOWDLP Tacoma Park. Your contributions and donations are tax deductible. We were listening to some classical music. Now we're going to take a little change of heart here.
Just a little one.
Yeah, for feelings about value and range. Listen in.
And now a rapid return visit to Top of the Pops by a trio which is blazing a trail through Britain with exciting new sounds. With their current top 10 hits, Purple Haze, here are the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Purple haze all around. Don't know just the end of time.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Park, 94.3 FM. You know, listening to one of the great all-time rock and roll songs by Jimi Hendrix, I was thinking how dimensional, we haven't talked about dimension in music, but how dimensional that song is. There's a lot of things going on simultaneously. And, you know, of course, there's these changes, you know, subtle changes of rhythm and tempo, which is just, you know, knocks me out. Let's talk about that for a minute. If you want to chime in there, Lyle, on the dimensionality, but also we're going to spend some time talking about rhythm and tempo.
Well, we don't really use the word dimension probably quite as much musically, but I mean, what you said I think is applicable to musical dimension. The let me deal with you were talking about rhythm and tempo. Let me take the easy word first.
Okay.
Tempo is how fast or slow the composition moves. I mean, that's the easy one. Rhythm refers to the underlying beat of the music, which we heard really well. You can hear that very clearly in Purple Haze, that underlying beat, as well as particular types of sound patterns that are overlaid on that beat, the syncopation, which again, you can hear in almost any song, and in particularly in modern, some of the modern music, jazz, and that.
I mean, are you referring to like the backbeat that we saw in Motown? Would that be?
Yeah, there's ongoing beat that's back. That's the beat of the music.
That's very interesting because, I mean, when we talk about tempo in visual art, and we don't use the exact word but it's how fast or slow one makes the mark on the canvas, like how the tempo of the mark making in a drawing or painting. Yeah. In other words, does an artist work frenetically and feverishly in making a piece of art? I mean, we could think about Jackson Pollock and his action painting from the New York abstract movement of the 40s and 50s, but also. You know, you think of Leonardo da Vinci, who took forever to work on a piece. He was very, very deliberate and slow and almost massaging the linen with his oil paints or tempera paints. So, you know, that's kind of a tempo in the attack. I call it the attack on the canvas.
And that's a very interesting aspect, too, because for composers, there's composers like Mozart, who people say, they say that he actually taught himself to write with both hands at the same time because the music was coming so fast in his head. And so he would compose just at a phenomenal speed compared to a Beethoven who would, as you noted, methodically. And with Da Vinci, he would take a theme and then work it and work it and work it and work it. And they actually have the progression of his symphonies, of where they started, and there's just pages and pages. So now we're going to go to something. So fasten your seat belt. We hope you don't get whiplash, but this is a whole different style here with Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. This was originally just written for a string quartet, and then he transcribed it for a full orchestra. And this, to me, is a very compelling piece of music, even though it's an extremely slow piece of music as far as tempo, but it's compelling because of the chord changes and the tempo is not the factor. It's the chord changes and it's the dynamics that are used. And it's significant. This piece was probably made most famous at the funeral of John F. Kennedy. So this was played. So let's take a listen to Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings.
Well, Lyle, that's a really beautiful piece of music, and I just have to use the word contrast after listening to Purple Haze by Jimi Hendrix, and then this.
Real contrast.
It's like, you know, the other side of the world. It's amazing.
You know, Tom, your reference to tempo and visual art is about the process of making art, and I mentioned briefly a couple of composers, but in music, it's the process of the performance of the composition that people usually refer to. Some musical tempo markings are vague, while others are very specific. But tempo is not necessarily a static term, even though it might be marked very specifically by the composer, because tempo can be modified in a performance by the conductor or the performer. And that sometimes is much to the dismay of the composer who wants a particular thing.
Right. Well, that's right at that moment, you know, in the setting of the making of the music.
Exactly.
Well, you know, you've opened up a whole new can of worms here.
Oh,
because,
sorry.
No, it's okay. Because the concept of musical process and performance is, you know, is very variable, as you say, to the conductors or the musicians, and it's a creative decision.
Exactly.
And it's about mood, competence of the performers, possibly the wellness of the performance, or the moment of performing the piece live, right?
I mean, exactly. And this is a really important aspect that many people don't think about, and one of the great values, I think, of live performance, because you can hear the same piece over and over and over again, but it may be very different on a live performance. what you hear on a studio recording of a piece of music is not the same as live performance. Sometimes they're being recorded live in the sense of it's just one take. But in a studio recording, there are often retakes. And these days, there are digital and technical adjustments that can very easily be made to embellish or to correct something that went wrong. For example, a singer or an instrumentalist who is flat or rhythmically off, you can take that one little thing out without having to do the whole piece over again.
Well, the key to this whole thing, and I think, you know, it's so important for our listeners, it's about the act of the art making. And we use the word rhythm in two ways in visual art. It could be the rhythm of the mark, meaning a great example of that would be Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night. His brushstrokes carry you across the canvas with a host of textures and colors and lines and shapes and forms. And that's really important, and it goes all around the canvas. And these mark rhythms are absolutely very indicative in Vincent van Gogh's work. In a Michelangelo's sculpture, I mean, such as even the unfinished ones, such as Dying Slave, which is very famous, it's filled with the rhythm of the chisel mark. In other words, we know the rhythm that he used to get that chisel to shoot across the three-dimensional form, and that's a fantastic thing. Most people forget that Leonardo da Vinci was the greatest lute player in the world at his time, but when you look at the rhythm of his marks in the brushstroke, I mean, I would really be interesting to see the difference in how he played the lute, mm-hmm. but they're very, very Maybe. Slow and rhythmic, and the rhythmic qualities is flawless in some ways with Leonardo da Vinci as opposed to Michelangelo, where there's a lot of flaws, but the rhythm is much more upbeat in that sense. And then I think another thing I always talk to my students about is that our own body rhythms. Mm-hmm. We have our own body rhythms, the way we breathe, the way we walk, the way we chew gum, the way, I mean, even puffing on a cigarette. I mean, I think of, you know, the smoky jazz, you know, of the, 20s and 30s. And, you know, there was so much energy in that space. And mm-hmm. and our biology kind of gives us these natural rhythms. And I think speaking of jazz, we'd like to kind of move on here to a movement that has a lot of process. And so let's listen to the great Duke Ellington. Thank you. Wow. Well, you know, you hear this music, and I'm just thinking, as we're bopping along here in the studio, of Boogie Woogie by Duke Ellington. That sounds like original recording. It's kind of fuzzy. I'm not sure about that, but it sounds like one.
It really does.
This was so influential to the abstract art movements of the 30s and 40s in America. And here's where, you know, the jazz age and abstract or visual art just, you know, knocked it out of the park simultaneously. We know that the Stuart Davis, Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Rad Reinhardt, so many of these artists were glued to jazz musicianship, the jazz era, and what jazz did for American art. And we have to kind of move along. There's so much connected here, but the dynamics in a piece of music is another vocabulary, and there's a lot of words associated with it. This is an interesting concept. In some ways, it differs from the visual arts, but how would you define dynamics, Lyle, in music?
Tom, traditionally, dynamics or volume and tempo or speed are marked with those sexy Italian words because they just sound better than German, which is a little more guttural. So words like piano, pianissimo, forte, mezzo forte, allegro, legato, staccato, grave, largo, andante, many more. Many of today's composers, though, choose to make these markings in their native tongue, but Italian still is used largely.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Well, maybe we'll go to lunch down the road here at some Italian place. But there's something to be said about language. In art, dynamism refers to the kinds of mark made. A dynamic visual is one that has many organic curvilinear marks on the work. And to contrast to static, which means marks that are imbued in a visual that are vertical and horizontal. And static works are usually energized by colors and spaces and possibly textures, like the Dutch painter Piet Mondrian, whose works are very static. But the color energizes these. How about the word bold? Do we use that in music?
Not a common term, but it would describe, I think, the piece we listened to at the beginning of the program, Fanfare for the Common Man by Aaron Copland. His use of brass and percussion makes this a bold piece of music. It's strong. It's insistent. It's a musical proclamation.
Oh, wow. Nicely said. How about edgy or edginess? Because that's a word sometimes we use in visual. It's an edgy piece. Mm-hmm.
It's not a technical term. I mean, I don't think you'll find it in your music dictionary, your Groves Music Dictionary, but it does get used for music that maybe is dissonant. For example, in modern terms, Charlie Ives or John Cage, or it might refer to culturally different, such as for the Westerners, the example that would be Chinese or Middle Eastern tonalities, some of which are on the quarter tone, and to the Western ear sounds off.
Like
it sounds off.
Yeah, Indian
to us,
music. Yeah.
Or music that's ahead of its time in the sense of what the listening public is accustomed to hearing. For example, people who were used to hearing Beethoven and classical music when Stravinsky wrote The Rite of Spring, one of his great classical pieces, history records that when that was performed in Paris, it caused a riot in the audience. People were up booing, yelling, throwing things because it was so contrary to what they thought music should sound like.
Wow, yeah, in that sense, it was edgy for the time. Well, in art, in visual art, we talk about hard and soft edges on a drawing or a painting, and the contour edge of the value of a line and the boundary between the object and the space. We sometimes have a soft something that's meaning fuzzy or smoky, which is an indistinct kind of fuzzy edge, which is called sfumato, another a sexy Italian word, which means smoky. And Leonardo da Vinci pioneered this, and you see this in the Mona Lisa. Her edges are indistinct, very soft and sensual. And in music, we also have something that we have to talk about right at this moment is accents. Phonic accents in a piece are really important. And define what this is and how they embellish a piece.
Accent in a musical composition gives emphasis to certain notes or sections of the music. Syncopation, which is accent on the offbeat, also add to interest and contrast of the composition. We're going to listen to a section of Gershwin's concert arrangement of An American in Paris. An American in Paris. So listen to how the accented use of the brass to create a sound image of horns honking on the crowded streets of Paris. It's really effective, enough that Toyota used this music for a car commercial, and it's been used in numerous movies as well.
Wow, that was so fun. Thank you for sharing that classic piece. But accents in visual arts are called visual emphasis or focal point, where your eye goes right to a point in a visual. You see this all the time in ads and advertising on the internet and TV. And there are many, many famous paintings. Artists like Winslow Homer used red a lot to kind of create a visual accent. It draws your eye right to something. And of course, the classic thing in beauty and stuff is like red lipstick. Red lipstick is a visual accent, or someone in a black gown with pearl necklace. That would be a visual accent. Wow. Well, visual emphasis and An American Paris is a good way to kind of close up the show. But Lyle, I've been thinking. Well, you really sound great on radio. Have you ever done radio before?
Never.
Never. Oh, welcome to the radio world.
Oh, thank you.
It looks like you have a possible other job opportunity in the future. Any closing comments, Lyle?
This has been a great experience with Tom, but we do miss Sheila. I've learned a lot about the connections between visual art and musical art, and thanks to our engineer, Bobby Hill, for helping us with all that music.
Well, thank you, Lyle, and we thank Bobby, as always, for doing such a great job. Well, the vocabulary of music and visual arts are really intertwined in the cross-pollination of art forms and culture. What we'd like to do is thank like so much of the history between these two art genres. It keeps art and powerful and enduring. Thank you, and we hope you've enjoyed the program. Sheila and I will continue our series on success and the artist with success and the mid-career artist. We have some special guests that day, local artists that are in their mid-career. It's going to be a great show, and we look forward to that. Experience art in everything you do, and thanks for listening. We'll see you in 2 weeks.